Jeffrey Wise is going to present the results of the...
I'm sure he is.
Okay, so this is a wrap-up of our think tank number 3 from this morning on Nocturia. The thrust of this discussion was really future directions in research in Nocturia. Just starting out about the definition of Nocturia, it's defined by the ICS as the complaint that the individual has to wake at night one or more times to void. Each void is preceded and followed by sleep. I would say probably the followed by sleep is unnecessary because many times patients are awakened at some point during the intended hours of sleep and simply fail to get back to sleep. So that's still a nocturic episode. Does the definition need to be changed? And this is a series of questions that we've posed, and I'm going to try to give some reflection on what we've discussed this morning about those things. Does the definition of nocturia need to be changed? In my view, no. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that when you arise at night any number of times, that's nocturia. Does it need to be subclassified? I think it's very useful, particularly through analysis of the 24-hour voiding diary, to try to get an idea as to whether nocturia is related to something the matter with urine production, whether it's global 24-hour, such as polyuria, or just nocturnal polyuria, which again is in and of itself related to numerous underlying conditions such as congestive cardiac failure, peripheral third spacing, obstructive sleep apnea, and also nocturnal bladder capacity, either as a separate issue that may be diminished or as related to global diminished capacity. Should we classify nocturia by age? Well, not necessarily, although nocturia is more bothersome in younger patients who are working. There is a greater economic burden calculable therein. However, nocturia is more prevalent in the elderly, not necessarily more bothersome. How about by gender? Well, there is a little bit of a difference, and also by age. Men have a little bit considerably less nocturia when they're younger, but then they catch up in their, let's say, sixth decade, and then easily surpass the prevalence of nocturia in women by the time they become elderly. How about quality of life? Age-related, gender-related, how do you measure quality of life? Well, take your pick. There's a number of instruments available. For example, the 15-dimension health-related quality of life, which is a very nice way to look at this. And Dr. Kari Tikkanen, whose thesis on nocturia from University of Tampere we discussed in detail this morning, describes the effects of increasing severity of nocturia on this 15-dimension health-related quality of life, and particularly things like pain, sleep quality, elimination, sexual function are very dramatically and regularly worsened with increasing severity of nocturia. The Nocturnal Enuresis Sleep Questionnaire, the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index, take your pick about measures of quality of life. And then at what point does quality of life begin to decrease, and by how much? And generally, when you read the literature, it's kind of understood that quality of life doesn't really kick in as an issue until nocturia times 2 or so becomes present. But in Dr. Tikkanen's work, he really found that the bother started at nocturia times 3. So it seems reasonable, somewhere between 2 and 3, that's where quality of life starts to precipitously decline in relation to severity of nocturia. So to improve this, what increment is necessary over placebo from the baseline, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, greater than 3? Certainly it would seem to me that it would be at least times 1 of an improvement for any particular treatment, whether it's behavioral or drug-related or surgical. How about the effects on productivity and the economic impact of nocturia? Should we just say that it's there and it's big? Well, there are models, and they do capture at least a number that you can calculate based on productivity diminution and also the cost of society based on falls and or fractures, and also perhaps related illnesses secondary to the primary consequences of sleep deprivation, whatever that may be. We don't really have all these answers. Just some calculations based on some theoretical models that are not necessarily even all that up to date. How about the effects of nocturia? For example, falls. How many falls? We talk about increased the relative risk of falls, fractures, mortality. How about the actual numbers? And if with regard to the falls and the fractures, are they falling at night on the way to the bathroom because it's dark and they're a little bit unsteady and they're a little bit dizzy when they get up? Or are they simply tired during the day and a little bit less careful in their gait, and are they falling during the day? Probably a combination, but these questionnaires that capture falls don't necessarily distinguish between them, and I sure would like to know the answer to that. So again, characterize nocturia by age, gender, baseline number, and how about nocturia as a primary or sole symptom? I think that's a really different animal than nocturia, which is jumbled up in a mass of daytime lower urinary tract symptoms. And I think I would be looking very carefully at a patient who only has nocturia and really no voiding problems during the day as someone who has a medical problem as opposed to a urological problem, and more likely to be something along the lines of nocturnal polyuria, which, as we know, again, has at least 5 demonstrable underlying conditions that are associated with it. So once we talk about treatment of nocturia, how do we describe success? What constitutes success? Well, I think the easiest thing is that nocturia times X becomes nocturia times X minus Y, so decreased episodes. How about the increased time to first awakening? That is probably beneficial overall because of the concept that the restorative sleep occurs supposedly in the first 4 hours or so. That's the so-called slow wave sleep. So increasing the time to the first awakening would be a reasonable goal over and above decreasing the overall number of nocturic episodes. How about total sleep time? That's something that really hasn't been captured very well, and I'm actually in the process of looking at that with regard to some of my own data, and also that as a sub-analysis of the FINO study that was done by Dr. Tikkanen. And again, increased quality of life, what measure? Well, we talked a little bit about measures of QOL. And also, what about clinical versus statistical significance? We certainly have seen a number of studies, particularly pharmaceutical studies, that demonstrate a statistically significant benefit of medications such as alpha blockers and antimuscarinics for nocturia, but I think most of us would agree that clinically these really are not very impressive. So going through these, what about antimuscarinics? No real evidence-based medicine to demonstrate that antimuscarinics help nocturia overall, although I think if you drill down on subcategories such as nocturic voids that are associated with severe urgency, that perhaps antimuscarinics may turn out to be beneficial. Alpha blockers, no EBM in favor. Combinations, no real evidence-based medicine in favor of that. How about behavioral modification? Little evidence-based medicine, but we definitely need more research along these lines. How about serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors? Well, no evidence in favor of those. How about outlet reduction? Contradictory results. There's an old study by Bruskowitz from 1986 that shows pre-TURP, 35% of patients had nocturia less than 2, non-severe nocturia, or clinically insignificant, we would say. And post-TURP, 91% had near resolution of nocturia. So therefore, why not do a TURP on everyone with nocturia? Well, the reason is more recent data suggests to the contrary. This is Yoshimura's on the bottom, the chart from 2003. This paper demonstrates that among the seven categories of the IPSS, nocturia had the least rate of response, although interestingly, the actual number of improvement of nocturia in that study was times one, which is better than most pharmaceutical studies. So mixed results here. Antidiuretic therapy, well, there is evidence-based medicine, but hyponatremia is always a looming threat. Watch out in terms of hyponatremia when administering desmopressin in patients who are elderly, those who have renal disease, cardiac disease, third spacing, tread lightly on those. Should we reserve antidiuretic therapy for patients with nocturnal polyuria or just those who have nocturia? Do we really need to know? Do we need to have studied them with diuresis before we ever treat them with an antidiuretic? Perhaps we don't need to have nocturnal polyuria. Perhaps all we need to do with antidiuretic therapy is to match nocturnal urine production with nocturnal bladder capacity. What about the suggestion that was made of studying first morning serum antidiuretic hormone and also urine sodium? Because if there's a natriuresis, then perhaps antidiuretic therapy would not be predicted to be effective. So should the parameters of nocturia research be standardized? Well, certainly I think the diary and whatever questionnaire that's validated that you find useful and your patients can understand and fill out properly and get a reasonable rate of return on this. And what statistical parameters are clinically meaningful? Certainly diary, questionnaires, quality of life scales, bother, economic burden, and mortality data. Those are all, I think, very important parameters over and above just how well do we do with nocturia. What level of improvement is clinically significant? Well, we might be able to capture the relationship between diminution of nocturia with the quality of life and correlate this with the quality of life improvement and improvement in bother indices. How about adverse events? What level of hyponatremia is tolerable or acceptable in terms of serum level and percent of those affected? And basically, we shouldn't have much of a tolerance for hyponatremia at all. That's a serious, potentially life-threatening side effect. Who should not receive desmopressin? Frail elderly, those with renal impairment, those with edema, certainly polyuria that's not been characterized, those with obstructive sleep apnea, we certainly have good options there, and cardiac disease. Other questions that we raise, what is sleep dysfunction? We really need a lot more cooperation between those of us who study nocturia in the urologic and urogynecologic fields and the primary sleep specialists. I've been disappointed over the last decade that we've really seen next to nothing along those lines. What's the threshold for daytime sleepiness? How do we measure the quality of sleep between awakenings? How about the issue of near nocturia? You don't necessarily need to get out of bed and go through micturition to have your sleep impaired by the by being awakened with the urge or the desire to pass urine. We should therefore be able to distinguish nocturic voids versus nighttime convenience voids, and we can do that if we add a column of an urgency perception scale so that we know exactly why the patient awakened and went to the bathroom at night. And these would be carefully correlated with questionnaires and perhaps through polysomnography. That would be really more of a research tool. So what about a goal? I think you have to look at treating nocturia with multiple incremental therapies because of its multifactorial nature. Occam's razor, the idea that there's usually a single underlying principle explaining a condition, really does not apply to nocturia. Should we construct algorithms similar to those in the ICI for nocturia in different groups and for both initial and specialized management? Well, one can imagine that these algorithms can be constructed and presumably based on subcategorization of nocturia, for example, nocturnal polyuria, global polyuria, low bladder capacity, and mixed etiologies. So any questions?
So, Jeff, we didn't really get into the epidemiology specifics this morning, but I was quite curious. Maybe you can answer it, or it could be a point of further discussion about nocturia as the primary or sole symptom. How often and what percentage of patients that have nocturia? Do you have an answer to that question?
Not at all. I can't think of anything. You know, when I've looked at my patients, I mean, I've really never done any population studies, and we have more or less a tertiary referral practice. So I really can't say that. I mean, we see it. It's an unusual patient, but those are the ones that really want treatment. I think it's much more likely that someone that has pure nocturia is very likely to put up with a lot of diagnostic, you know, getting repetitive diaries and a workup and then repeated visits to try to get the thing right. But the question about epidemiology of primary nocturia, it's a good question. I think perhaps there is a database out there.
I would ask.
Well, yeah, I think we have to look at the FINO and perhaps ask that question. I couldn't come up with a quick answer. Rude. Perhaps could tell us about what he knows from the Crimpen study, and that may be the best, because there you have diary data, and I think that's probably the only study where you have all of those diaries for a longitudinal study. That's all the questions on nocturia. Brother?
When you talk about hyponatremia, then you refer to when you are outside the range of normal values for that particular laboratory you use. Isn't that what
yes.
your definition of hyponatremia?
Yes, it depends on how many fences you want to build around the level of 135.
Yeah, but you know that within even the normal range, you have a reduction of serum sodium. And that can be, you go from the upper limit of serum sodium to close to, but still within normal values. How do you regard these changes? Because there is a change, and I think the change is maybe more important than the absolute value.
Oh, if you're treating a patient and their sodium goes from 147 to 135, that's a problem, and that patient needs to be followed very closely. Now, the thing is, a lot has been made about the difficulty in diagnosing hyponatremia. Last I checked, it's a serum sodium. You know, we're doing these pelvic organ prolapse operations and retroperitoneal node dissections. Getting a serum sodium is no trick. So I think it's easy enough to check if there's a concern. I think if someone has as a baseline a low normal serum sodium, and particularly if they have risk factors, elderly, other medications that might predispose to hyponatremia, I'd be hesitant to use the drug in the first place. But definitely the change is the thing. And correction should be done deliberately and slowly, not too fast.
Many patients self-treat by fluid restricting in the evening. Is there any role, value in that? What time should they do it? Any evidence for it?
Most of the patients that we see with a primary complaint of nocturia have already figured out that they should restrict their fluids. It doesn't seem to work very well. There's usually, so I find that form of behavioral therapy to be practically useless, and there's usually something else going on. The first thing that I'm looking at is third spacing. I mean, I can just literally look right down, lift up the trouser leg, and say, there you go, you have swelling. No, I don't. You press, yes, they do. And it's very common. And then the next thing, we do a diarrhea, we find nocturnal polyuria. They have no cardiac issues, there are no meds, they don't have any edema. I'm looking for obstructive sleep apnea. If you don't think about it, if you don't do diaries, if you don't order sleep studies, you don't find it. The shame of that would be that you miss the opportunity to treat something that really is treatable, for which I don't know that there's any better treatment for any underlying condition that is known to cause nocturia than continuous positive airway pressure for the condition of obstructive sleep apnea.
Thanks, Jeff. Tony, are you going to do that?
Sure.